Hey yo, and here we go. It's We Talk Comics special, the Red 10 edition. Today we're joined by Tyler James and Caesar. Caesar, please pronounce your last name for me.
Yeah, that's Feliciano.
Feliciano. Damn, your last name is much cooler than mine. And of course, I'm here with Brett today. Brett, say hello.
Hello.
And Keith.
Hi, I'm here.
Excellent. And what we're here to do today is talk a little bit about, if you've been listening to our show, we've had some independent books sent to us by Comics Tribe and Tyler James, Caesar, The Red 10. We did a review of that show recently. We really enjoyed that book, and they're kind enough to give us their time today to talk a little bit about the process and what they're doing. So what we're going to do here is we're going to let Brett open up with the first question. He wanted to get into it a little bit with you guys. So, Brett, floor is yours.
All right. Well, my first question is just a pretty basic one. So what brought you into comic books? Why did you choose this medium? And also, you know, what kind of books influenced you when you were first starting out?
So this is Tyler. I will jump in and just say that, you know, I've been doing comics, for a long time now. You know, started drawing them probably in second, third grade, just noodling around and then really got serious, in the middle school and high school years, dropping completely through college when I discovered beer and women and all that other fun stuff, the occasional studies, and then sort of picked them back up in my mid-20s and have been grinding pretty hard for the last 5 years to start to you know, build up a little bit of a following and get my work out there. And I just think it's a brilliant medium. I love art, and I love the combination of words and art and the fact that, you know, you don't need a massive budget. You just need, you know, imagination, and that can really let you go to town on comics. So that's sort of where I come from. I know, Caesar, how long you been doing this thing, man?
Well, I tell you what, with comics and me, you know, since I was a little kid, growing up really poor where I did, living in the projects in Hartford, Connecticut, to me it was just a way of escape from the reality that I was living in, you know. Pretty poor. And I just remember playing superheroes with my friends, and I remember the first thing that I saw was a John Buscema Hulk comic, and I was like, wow, that is so powerful, you know, the big muscles, the just how strong he was and everything. I was like, you know what, I would love to be the Hulk, but I was kind of short, so I couldn't be the Hulk, but in any event, you know, and then just over the years, just kind of really liked comics. And, you know, like you, Tyler, I took a break when I joined the military, and I was in the Marine Corps for a few years. And, you know, after I got out, met my wife and stuff, and then got reintroduced to comics again back around 1989 or so. And, you know, started kind of fiddling around drawing, and, you know, I was like, hey, I could probably do this if I really put my heart to it, because I always doodled around. And they've just kind of been working at that trade, you know. I love John Byrne. He was one of my biggest influences. Like I said, John Buscema. Not too much into Kirby, because I just thought it was kind of wonky, but I appreciated as I got better at drawing what he actually brought to the table, and I'm like, wow, I can really appreciate what he did. So that's kind of like my thing at up to this point.
Okay, terrific. It's Mo again. I'm just gonna jump in if the other guys don't mind. I kind of have a follow-up question on that. I'll pose this one to Caesar first, and then we'll get Tyler's answer this time and go in the snake draft format. And basically, you talk about how much you kind of talking about your origins there. How much of what you're doing is because you want it to be a career, and how much of it is just out of the love of the medium?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't think that I would even attempt to do it as a career unless I actually enjoyed it. Because with me, I've had regular jobs, for instance, but I would love to just do something that I was in love with, and so I would say that my love for comics comes first and then comes trying to make it a career where it's viable. Because even if that never happened, I think I would still be creating comics.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is sort of what I did as a kid when I had, you know, nothing better to do. When the homework was done, the vegetables were eaten, the chores were half done. You know, I was doing pages and I was grinding at the table and telling stories. And I think when I just look at the times in my life that I feel most alive, it's when I'm involved in a creative process to tell a story. So I think when I wasn't doing comics, I kind of in the back of my mind said, yeah, it'll be nice to be old and retired, and because then I'll probably just draw comics all day. And like I looked at like my grandfather who worked himself to the bone for 40 years and then retired, and then he did his true love, woodworking and stuff, and did that for the last 20 years of his life. But I think right around 20, 25, I kind of just knew something was missing, and there was a creative void that was missing, and I just kind of on a whim took a class on comic script writing, which got me back into the hobby from the writer's side. I had always sort of written and drawn my own thing growing up, but I kind of knew that I'd never be able to tell all the stories that I want to tell as a comic creator if I had to draw them all, because you know there's just some art styles and some and some skill levels that and some stories that need to be told with an artist that has a style to match that perfectly, I think the fact that I have some artistic talent in this industry is very helpful, but some of the things that I enjoy the most is collaborating with other super talented artists, because we can have a bigger footprint and really make more of an impact when the magic of collaboration happens. So, but in terms of a career, I would love for this to be a part of what I do for the rest of my life, and I would love for it to be sustaining, a self-sustaining endeavor, and also, eventually put some money in my pocket. Now, I just the state of the industry, and when you especially in the past month, it's been a little bit depressing when you're reading about established guys talking about how hard it is for them to make ends meet. So I'm a little skeptical that only doing comics and is the way I'll be able to make my money or make a full enjoyable living. But I think I always want it to be a part of what I'm doing. So that's sort of my current way I look at it.
Yeah, well, I think I have about 27 follow-up questions based on those, but then I'll give Keith a chance to jump in and ask something.
Let's get into Red 10. Now, this is inspired in part by Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None. So, Tyler, tell me a bit about just why that story appeals to you. What made you think of applying that classic tale to superheroes?
It's a good question. I think, I believe I read that book the first time in fifth grade, and then I actually didn't reread it until I had already did a first pass at what the Red 10 would be, and then I went back and studied the source material. And the amazing thing that I found from the source material was that even though I had already read it before, it was still until the very, very end of the book, I couldn't remember who actually was behind the whole thing. And I'm like, wow, that was extremely well done for, and I think part of, part of where the idea to do this series came from was just sort of, you know, me being a comic book reader slash skeptic of what the Big Two was doing, and just kind of the endless let's raise sales with a cheap kill off gimmick, but not really kill them, and polybag the issue, and then they're back, and just kind of like, you know,
they would
like,
never do that.
Yeah, and just a little bit frustrated with that, and just thinking, you know, hey, why not just have a company wide manifesto, Marvel and or DC, where you just kill a character in every single issue for the rest of the year, polybag them all, you know, and just go all the way with it. Why not?
Well, they already are doing that, aren't they?
And I mean, they're pretty close. But then, as is wont to do, from, you know, out of a little bit of frustration or snark, then the idea came, well, huh, what would a miniseries look like if a character died in every issue? And then that sort of brought me to the Agatha Christie hook, and just thought that, you know, for the combining that with a superhero universe or, you know, an Agatha Christie meets the Justice League is something that, I hadn't seen done before. And, I thought is a perfect device just for, you know, hitting those cliffhangers and keeping the readers coming back, for more. And then, you know, going back and studying the source material and studying, you know, the versions of other people that took the Agatha Christie, and then there were non-trope and played with it. You know, there was a great Family Guy episode where they did, and then there were fewer or something. And just seeing, you know,
premiere, I believe, last year.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great. But just seeing, you know, how I could play with that, what I could take from it. And then it just seemed like a really cool, structure to build from, but then, it has enough freedom to let you go and take it in your own direction. I mean, I think if you've read and are a fan of the Agatha Christie, you're going to find some Easter eggs, but some nice allusions to the source material. At the same time, I don't think it'll help you solve the mystery any easier because I'm knowing what I know and using that hopefully to my advantage as I'm plotting it and writing it out. So that's sort of what I'm thinking there. And then Caesar and I had met at a convention in Connecticut, not this year, but the previous year, and you know, just another magic of social media. I followed him on Facebook and saw him post that he scheduled freed up and he was looking to collaborate. And I immediately shot him a message and sent him 5 pitches. And this was the one that he gravitated to the most. So, you know, it was off to the races after that.
Now, do you share responsibility for creating the character designs?
I took a stab at about 6 or 7 of them. Actually created them during the 30 characters challenge last year. And then I sent what I had to Caesar at the beginning of the year. He did a nice pass of polishing them up and did some cool things to add on them. And then there were some characters I didn't have a full red 10. I didn't have them all. So Caesar helped design a few.
Caesar, yeah. When Tyler came to you with this, and he designs these characters or some of them there, it seemed to me that there was a template from established characters that kind of he was playing with. Did you think that as well? And how did that influence your character design for the other ones?
Well, when I saw the initial designs that Tyler had done, there was a lot of information already there, and I could tell in a certain way where he was going with this. And the first impression that I got was like, oh, these are Justice League characters. They're DC characters, okay? So I don't know if that was what he was intentionally going for when he sent me his first designs, but that's my first impression. personally, I love the Marvel characters, but there's such a rich history with the DC characters that I really got the whole mystique of what he was trying to do. And so when I saw those, there were some that were kind of cool. I'll say Oxymoron just to begin with. I think that's, Tyler would agree, out of all the characters, I think Oxymoron is the one that's more a fan's sketch. The ones that I've had the most requests to draw at shows or signings, same thing with Tyler. I think that the Oxymoron character has probably had the most artist edition sketches that out of any character. And the reason for that is because there's something very Joker-ish about him. And so one of the things that I wanted to do with that character was kind of exaggerate it a little bit more. So I added a bigger grin. I added teeth that you could see. I made the eyes and the design around the eyes more alive so that it would move with the expressions that Oxymoron was trying to express. I also added a little bit more tailoring to his suit, and maybe even, well, there'll be some variations on that suit, kind of like with the Joker. He's got a standard look, a color look, but then he has variations on the designs of the clothing that he wears, and so we'll see some of that in the future Red 10 issues. I've even did some sketches, some study sketches, that sort of thing that I shot over to Tyler while we were kind of doing all the pre-work on this. But that's just one instance. There were a few others where, you know, just kind of designed them a little bit more so that they would be more familiar to people. As they look at the Red 10, they would say, oh yeah, that's the Nightwing character, or yeah, that's the Wonder Woman character, and that sort of thing. So just kind of brought some of those things and tightened them up so that there would be more understanding of the people reading the Red 10 visually, that they would say, okay, yeah, I know these characters already, and I know what these guys are trying to do.
Yeah, I think, you know, the reason it seems like it's more... they're closer to the DC than it is Marvel's, because just DC, you know, is more about the archetypes. You know, Spider-Man isn't really an archetype as much as say a Superman, you know, the ultimate hero, or you know the robot, the warrior woman, etc. And the format of the series was always going to be, okay, the Red 10, it's a 10-issue series. Each issue, one of these characters is going to die, and the team is going to get one fewer with each issue, and one of them is likely behind it all. And so that was the big pitch. And to introduce and kill a character in each issue, part of the reason I wanted to, you know, stick to archetypes that people are going to know and be familiar with is because it's sort of shorthand for, okay, I know who this person is, because, I have limited pages to, there's a lot of characters to introduce, and I have limited pages to do it in such a way that you'll care, or at least feel like, you know, you've got something out of them going bye-bye. So that's sort of what I'm doing. And then also, you know, we all have our preconceived notions about, you know, a Superman, a Green Lantern type, a Wonder Woman, and et cetera. But, you know, these are not them. And as each issue proceeds, you know, each of these characters is harboring something deep and dark and very not Justice League. So... seeing the twists on that is something that I think people are, or I hope people are going to enjoy as the series develops.
As you read each issue, you will see the foreshadowing about each character, both visually and within the story, and you're going to say there's something not quite right. And then when the big a reveal comes, you'll say, oh, okay. And then you'll be drawn back to, okay, let me see where were the clues. I know they were there. So we're trying to keep it interesting. I think Tyler's doing a great job with that.
You're terrific. I have a couple questions based on that. Number one, the cover for this was done not by Caesar, but by Charles Paul Wilson III. I have the issue right ahead of me. It's a striking cover, and it features Oxymoron on the cover. Was that his decision? Was that a character he gravitated towards as well? And my follow-up, or how did he come around the book, and how did the decision of who's going to be on the cover get there? And my follow-up question is, since that character is so popular, would you go back and do a series with him? Has there been any thought of that?
So those are good questions. So I worked with CP on the cover. I sort of gave him two different versions, just in text, and I think a very rough, you know, chicken scratch as far as ideas. And sort of we went back and forth a little bit on what it would be. And honestly, it may or may not be a spoiler, but this, well, I won't say too much, but when you read the story, whether or not the image on the cover of issue one ever actually happened is something that becomes a little bit in doubt. So to a certain extent, it may or may not be a fake out cover, which is something that I actually wanted to do. But, you know, one of the reasons I put, I wanted the Oxymoron to be, you know, a really creepy looking dude in a white suit is because I wanted that suit covered in blood and on the image of a cover to just sort of, you know, send a message, nice and early, to what you're getting into and to get a reason for it. But, so I think it's all on Charles for just making it into a very striking, iconic cover. Also, Ty Tyner did covers on this as well. So I want to give shout outs to him as well because he did a strong job on that. I think it's probably the best thing he's ever colored. So that was part of it. And then, if we are giving the spoiler alert, in the first issue of the Red 10, we find our super popular Oxymoron character is, met an interesting fate. And so, to a certain extent, I've kicked myself, oh, he's the most popular character and there's reason to believe he might not show up again. There is, in issue three, there's a pretty nice flashback with, where we get to see a little bit more about the Oxymoron. But I think the character himself, who is sort of, your psychopathic nemesis, who is obsessed with contradiction and sort of uses that to base some of his killing, I think is just a very cool idea. And so, yes, I haven't announced it yet, but I am working right now on something really, really cool with this character. And it's probably the biggest thing that I've ever organized because I'm sort of, much like this is my chance to write the death of the Justice League. I know there are a lot of writers out that I know who have some Joker stories in them, and would love to tell them. And so I've sort of extended an invitation to some of my some up and coming indie writers and guys that are doing pro work right now that are getting some buzz to sort of pitch me Oxymoron shorts, and so I'm gonna collect them into an anthology or a trade, and it's cool. All of the shorts are titled from the name of an Oxymoron. So, you know, you have the Oxymoron starring in Quiet Riot or Nearly Perfect and so we're definitely, there will be seeing more of this character. And I'm hoping to include some others in it and have some fun with it.
Awesome. That's a scoop. We got a scoop.
Yep. You guys got an exclusive. So there you go.
Excellent. Keith, Keith, you know what? Why don't you ask it the next question, because I could go on for a while. And yes, ask it now.
So you're distributing Red 10 a bit at a time. You're not doing mass marketing or mass distribution to start. What was the thinking behind that decision?
Well, so, I mean, I think the independent creator has, you know, I think you've never really had as many options for how you can go about getting your products out there. And, you know, over the past 5 years, I've experimented with a lot of them. Comics Tribe is sort of an independent label that myself and some others created at the beginning of this year. And so we have a small stable of books that are coming out under Comics Tribe. I feel like you guys have looked at just about all of them, which is awesome. But so right now the direct market system is really pretty much set up to favor the big two. I mean, you can look at the pie charts of what gets sold and how you go about getting it sold. And it's really a business that thrives on a monthly release schedule, and it's mostly Marvel and DC, and Image can get, you know, Image gets some attention because it's in the front of the book. So, and it has a 20-year track record now of putting out, pretty high quality books. But then there's a big backlist of books that really kind of disappear. So my, sense with this book, I think we're planning to eventually, you know, give the direct market going through Diamond an honest shot, but that's only going to make sense to do it when you can sort of release books, and release them on that monthly schedule and keep it going. So our choices were to bank series and not get them out there, not do anything, for a while until we had 4 or 5 issues in the can. Go or start building a little bit of a following and at conventions and in local retailers and see about self distributing and try to just build a bit of an audience for the book so that when we do actually make a direct market push, it already has some awareness. So that's sort of where we're at right now. Right now we're in 22 stores and we're picking up a couple of orders issue 2 are already a lot more than they were on issue 1. So, it's fun. It's exciting stuff. But, yeah, I mean, there's so many different models out there. There's web comics. Some people are trying digital only. There is going directly through Diamond. There's, pitching to publishers. A lot of independent creators like myself are just, are trying different things. And we've been fortunate enough to get pretty good retailer support so far. So we're just going to try to keep building on that.
So you said you're trying to bank some pages, bank some books. What are you working on? What issue are you working on right now?
We're still
on issue 2, right? Yeah.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Caesar's in the middle of issue 2. I'm writing issue 4 right now. So the books will come out first at the retailers that we've been, you know, talking to directly and working with directly. I'd imagine, you know, once we hit about issue 4 and issue 4 is finished, we'll sort of re-release the earlier issues through the through Diamond and make another national push, but the retailers that supported us early on will have had it first and had the first printings, et cetera, et cetera. So, it's all a work in progress. It's all trying things out, seeing what works, what doesn't. But you know, we've had some good reactions to signings and people that have picked up the book. I've got a lot of good feedback and a lot of people interested and can't wait for issue 2. So. We're excited about that, I think.
Right. And one of the things that if I could just add.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to add real quick. One of the advantages of actually having these books out at the local retailers first and and having creating a fan base and getting feedback from guys like yourself and other reviewers of independent comics is that before we release to the direct market, it gives us an opportunity to see what was working in the first issue, what didn't work, and then some of those comments and critiques are actually been very helpful in working in the second issue. I think that once you see the second issue, it is going to be it's going to be like a quantum leap, not only in the level of the art, but the whole production quality, the inking, the coloring, lettering, even the story wise. And so our thought is when we go to the direct market to release and let the direct distributor know that, yeah, you know, we have issues banked and they'll be coming out on a regular basis. Even in the first issue, Tyler and I have talked a little bit back and forth, and there's some, without changing the structure of the story, we'll be making some changes and smoothing some rough edges out so that there's more consistency from the first issue going forward. And I think that that's one of the things that's been very helpful about using this particular model. And definitely, we definitely want to support our local comic distributors, comic shops, and give them first crack at these things, because realistically, without them, we wouldn't have an avenue to really get our books out there in people's hands and have their support, because they're really pushing our books, and we really appreciate that quite a bit.
I have a follow-up question for each of you. I'm going to give Caesar yours first here. Actually, one of the things that's interesting is today we were down at a comic book shop, and the gentleman there who runs this shop, we were there to pick up your book specifically. I brought it in. I had a nice display for it, and he said to us, "This is a good-looking book. I'm getting a lot of feedback from people to pick it up. They're saying it doesn't look or feel like an independent book. It can stand up next to one of the major publishers as far as the quality and feel of the look of the book." Did you kind of think to yourselves, you think that's one of the major keys for distributing it? Is that something that you're aware of?
I would say absolutely. I think that in this particular type of book, I think that's what we're trying to strive for, and that's what I'm striving for, because, you know, we're talking about archetypes, we're talking about Justice League type characters, and so in order for it to be something that is palatable for people that are not used to picking up an independent comic, but that could possibly pick up and are picking up the Red 10, for them to see that, you know, independent comics are another place where we can put our money, because they're producing quality stuff. Now, there are some independent comics out there that are fantastic, but there's a lot of independent comics out there that just seem like, you know, a couple guys threw it together in, you know, the bathroom, and they ran it on a printer and say, let's put this out. So, I consider what I do very professionally, and so I study, and I don't mind getting critique, because that only helps me, and I study different methodology, because I want to produce the very best possible product and put that on paper for people to absorb. And one of the nice things about working with a guy like Tyler is that he understands that, and you know, he gives me feedback on my art, you know, when I finish a page, I say, "Hey Tyler, take a look at this. Is this what we were trying to go for in this particular page?" And I'll get a few comments here and there. And you know, the nice thing about it is that when we were first starting this book, I mean, it was like long emails. Yeah, you need to fix this. You didn't grab this right, and this, that, and the other. Lately, it's been very minor changes. So I think that we're clicking, and we're producing the type of book that should be right there with the major books, because there's a lot of great creators out there in the independent market that can stand right alongside major publishers and fans and readers should really give these books a try. I mean, Sam Humphrey's Sacrifice is a great example. The Cape is another a great book. And so, you know, that's really our thought process, at least my thought process. I believe Tyler's on the same page as that. We want to make the very best product that we can.
Yeah, I think...
Okay, Tyler,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, you know, at a comic book convention or where you're sitting in Artist Alley and I can pitch my book, you know, I've become a pretty good salesman when it comes to, you know, telling people about my product. I think they should check it out. And so convention sales are usually pretty good for me. Like, I'm able to move some books and get people interested. But the problem is, you know, at conventions, I have the ability to engage and to pitch. And then people that are walking in Artist Alley are interested in indie stuff anyway. But in the comic shop, which is ultimately where I want my stuff to be read and talked to, I'm not there pitching these books. So they have to be able to, you know, stand out on the shelf, hang, but they need to stand out and really grab the reader and then not let go when the reader picks up the book. So, I think we're getting there. And that's always going to be the bar that we're trying to set. We're hoping that readers, you know, are enjoying it as much as they do any of the other big company supported and funded books that are out there.
Okay, my question actually, that's interesting because it kind of does lead into this, Tyler. I've been in many comic book shops where I walk in and I look for small press books or the alternative books, and I go to that shelf and it's Image, Dark Horse, IDW, maybe Boom, Boom Studios. Yeah, it's not actually finding books that I would consider independent to purchase and support. My viewpoint of what those might be and the store's viewpoint of what those might be are obviously often very different. So I'm kind of wondering, what do you think on that? Does that affect your marketing as well?
I think that's part of the reason we're doing it on a shop-by-shop basis. Like, I'm when I go one shop at a time, I'm not just saying, hey, you want to carry my book? I'm saying, you know, here's why you want to carry my book. Here's what it's about. Here's how you sell it to your audience.
Frustrating to have to break down that barrier, Tyler?
I don't like the retailers. Retailers have it tough. Unlike most bookstores that can return and usually end up returning, you know, some 40% of their stock for credit. Retailers really can't do that, you know. So anytime they're dropping, you know, $2 or whatever they are on independent books, you know, is money that they're not spending on big two books, which they have an established track record of selling and are the bread and butter of their shop. So I definitely don't mind helping them, helping them push the book. But it is interesting, you know, like one of the retailers that was carrying my book, I think was shocked to move 5 copies of the thing. And it just so happened one of my friends was in there and to buy the book and he picks up the last copy and he sends me a text. He's like, oh, dude, there's only one copy left. Should I buy it? And I'm like, yeah, buy it and tell him he's out. that's probably the best thing you could do for me. And so he did. And then wouldn't leave until the guy promised to go restock. So I did get a message, that the guy needed more books, a day later, which is pretty cool.
Excellent.
But you know, like the, the toughest thing is you know, a big indicator about whether or not a book is going to sell, or whether or not a retailer is going to have confidence in it selling is, you know, have the people who are behind it or involved in it made me money before? And if that's a no, then they need to see it. And that's part of one of the reasons why starting local and establishing local connections can be very powerful for an independent creator. Because, you know, everybody's got to start somewhere. And so, you know, independent comics is very, very much a retail, one person at a time, one reader at a time thing. But, you know, you stick with it and keep producing and let the people that are in on the story, you know, if you deliver for them, that's how you grow. That's how you keep building it. So that's sort of where we're at.
Yeah, you know, they're just, it's true, they're just trying to feed their families too. Brett, you have a question you wanted to ask, so please go ahead.
Well, I'm just interested, you know, you touched on it before, so I'm kind of wondering about, like, what your workflow is to move on. Like, you say that, like, Caesar, you say that you're penciling at issue 2, and then Tyler, you said that you're writing issue 4. So how do those kind of match up, and how do you, like, continue to get it out there, and what's your start to finish from, like, beginning of the writing process to getting it out to the realtor or the retailer?
So in terms of how the Red 10 is done from a process standpoint, I spent a weekend doing a full plot of how everything works out and all the major beats for each of the issues and how they break down. And then I'll tackle an issue by check that issue out. I'll do a couple of drafts, send to my editor, Stephen Forbes, who's the co-creator of and editor-in-chief of Comics Tribe. And, you know, he'll kill me for a little bit and call out some things that don't make sense and tell me where I can make things better. And I'll polish another draft or two. And then I ship off to Caesar. At which point, Caesar, what's your process?
Yeah, so then what happens at that point is that, you know, I have a 20-plus page script. What I learned a few years back to do is, as opposed to a lot of artists that just kind of do a layout a few pages at a time, what I learned is that you lay out the whole book, and I do, like, really small thumbnail sketches, get those all laid out. I'll ship those over to Tyler. He kind of goes over them, checks the flow. I'll get him back with any kind of notes, and then I'll do some tighter, bigger layouts for each page, and keeping in mind that we're laying out the whole book so that there's some kind of consistency, some kind of continuity, so they don't, you know, as artistically, you know, when you're penciling, you kind of, you know, there's stops and starts, and you could lose your place, so doing it this way helps you stay on a more continuous basis so that, you know, you're not forgetting to draw something that you had a couple pages before, you know, and then you'll get an email or a fan letter saying, hey, you forgot to draw such and such on this and it was over here. So once I do that, I'll get those final layouts to Tyler and Steve. They'll kind of look them over and add any other notes. I'll get those back. And then at that point, what I do is I'll have the script, I'll have the layout, I pull out a big 11:17 piece of copy paper, and I'll start working the layouts out on big size, just kind of really loosely figuring out where I'm positioning everything, figuring out what I'm putting in the background, getting all my references together and everything. And once I do that, I kind of do a more finished layout, once I'm happy with that tightened up 11:17 layout, I'll throw that on a light box and I'll put a clean sheet of Bristol board on there, and then I'm just kind of going over the layout, not so much tracing, but just kind of making sure I have all the information there, because even as I'm putting it, working it on the light box, I'm making minor changes here and there. Once I get that all settled in, I go in and I tighten up the pencils. I'll shoot those over to get a final once over, from Steve and from Tyler. Any minor details that I might have missed, or maybe an angle or something, lighting, something like that needs to be addressed. I'll go ahead and do that. Usually it's a quick fix. Then those go over to the anchor, and as far as that, my part is done. But I find that this process has helped Tyler and I, two issues that we've been working on, to keep a more consistent story.
On behalf of We Talk Comics, before we say OET, we're going to thank you guys very, very much for your time and give you the opportunity to give any last plugs as well as shout-outs to anybody else who worked on the book and may have contributed that you know, they should not be old.
Red 10, number one, obviously, Steve and I played our parts, but the book wouldn't have colored it, and Jimmy Kennison inked and assisted on some pages, and then obviously C.P. Wilson and Ty Tyner, who collaborated on the cover, and Steve Forbes, who edited that, and all the books that I do, who's a great dude. We're joined with a new inking and color artist for issue two, but we'll give plenty of it on them next time we talk to you.
Right.
So keep an eye out over at Alpha Comics. I believe that's where you guys picked up your copies. For issue two, which should be up their way come February.
Fantastic. And Caesar, any last words?
You know, basically, I wanted to thank you guys for giving us an opportunity to talk about our project. It's a labor of love, and it's great working with Tyler and I really think we're doing something special here, something that is hopefully it's going to catch the attention of the market out there and really just kind of let people out there know that, hey, you know what? Check out the independent market, because there's a lot of great stuff going on out there. And, you know, if our book can be a small part of that and kind of broadening people's horizons on the different creators out there, you know, we're more than happy, to do, our part. I just want to say that, April in Boston, I think, Tyler is going to be our first convention of the year at the Boston Comic Con. We're definitely going to have copies of the Red 10, hopefully issue 1, 2, maybe even 3 might be available there. So if anyone in the Canadian area or in the Boston area or anywhere in the United States wants to come out there, check out our books. Also keep an eye at your local comic shops such as Alpha and many of the local shops in New England. We appreciate all your support.
Fantastic. Well, Tyler, Caesar, thanks again for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks, guys. We appreciate you having us. We'll be submitting our new book, Scam, number one, by Joe Mulvey, which is a Comics Tribe January release. We'll be sending that your guys' way for a review. So don't think you're done with getting your inbox peppered from us.
Can't wait, Tyler. Can't wait. Excellent. Thanks again, guys. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having the time, guys.
Thank you.